2 years ago, Idaho courts made the owner of World Plus Incorporated return investor money, fined her $2,500, and told her not to operate in the state again. Those facts came to light Thursday afternoon when a Fairbanks investor waved Idaho court papers at Jeannie Bonham and asked her to explain. But Bonham dodged that question and many others by invoking her Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. Bonham denied allegations that she ran a Ponzi scheme, but in Thursday's three-hour meeting, she failed to account for an estimated $50 million in assets. Investor John Schiller has given up any hope of seeing his $30,000.
I'm not what you would say old. I'm not young by any means, but the ones I feel sorry for are the ones that have lost all their money, that are probably in retirement age right now, that are really, really totally out of it. I've got years yet to work to her. This here is just a temporary setback, basically. But there are some people there that are retired that will never have a chance to make that money back again.
Some investors shook their heads and made for the door when Bonham claimed she could still jumpstart her failed flight coupon business and pay her debts. Thursday's meeting was the first time many of them had a chance to question Bonham face-to-face since January, when bankruptcy judge Herbert Ross ordered World Plus liquidated. Bonham no-showed a similar meeting in February. She phoned in to answer creditor questions, saying she feared for her life. Judge Ross then threatened her with a contempt citation and jail if she failed to make Thursday's meeting. Bonham is being investigated by federal authorities. She still lacks a lawyer. The court-appointed trustee meets with Bonham again on Monday. He'll also start videotaping and cataloging her assets at home for future liquidation, as well as search for business records. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
In the early 70s, 23-year-old homesteader John Neal found pilot Don Sheldon to haul all the lumber from a building he had previously built in Anchorage to his remote homestead on the Tokositna River. The building in Anchorage had to be torn down and sheets of plywood cut small enough to fit into the Cessna 180. Neal was hoping to land on the lake next to the home site. February winds and hard-packed snowdrifts for Sheldon to land a quarter mile away on the river.
And the wind was, turbulence are really bad. It was blowing pretty hard, about 20 below zero. And we finally get down on the river, and he opens the door up and says, "Hurry up, get out, guys. I can't hold this thing on the ground anymore." You know, he starts pitching gear out, and we start throwing it out. Next thing I know, his plane's gone, and I'm standing on the river, and it's 20 below zero.
Neal and his two friends picked up the 80-pound army tent and spent the rest of the day hauling supplies through the woods to the home site. They then proceeded to dig through the 7 feet of snow to put their tent up so they could survive the night.
I'd never seen the spot where we put the tent up in the summertime, so I didn't realize that we're pitching this tent over a really wet, boggy hole. Dig all the snow off, ground's froze, build a fire in there, next thing I know, it's starting to get real damp.
The next day, he dug another hole for a spot to build the cabin. The men spent days chopping and tromping and smoothing out the drifts in the lake for an airstrip so Sheldon could fly materials in.
The drifts on the lake were just as hard as a rock. You had to take an axe and chop them out and shovel it and fill in holes. And everything took a little longer than what you expect, you know, especially being a novice.
The men hauled the foundation logs by hand and spent about a month putting the building up. Last week, they were spending the nights in the cabin. Neal returned in the summer with the rain and mosquitoes to finish the work. The next winter, Neal began to run his trap line. We'll follow his first season opening for Martin in the next story. In Talkeetna, I'm Kathy Sullivan.
Even after setting a record as the highest-placing rookie ever in 1982, unable to secure sponsorship again, it wasn't until this year's Iditarod that Tanana trapper Stan Zaray was able to afford an attempt at the last great race again. With a thick accent, the 46-year-old Boston expatriate and father of four says that when he finally had $5,000 clear this year to spend on something, the Iditarod jumped to mind.
I just wanted to see again, you know, if it was possible to maybe come in top 20, make a little money maybe with a, you know, team that you put together.
Though he and his dogs haven't changed much, the race has. From his plywood-sided sled, bearing the names of supporters and Black Magic Marker, the ponytailed Zaray says the modern Iditarod employs things tough to come by in a bush village.
You know, you just don't have the expertise out in the its run, because it's not, I mean, this race isn't driving dogs. It's almost like a science or a technical thing, you know. And you're competing with people with four handlers, you know, and 100 dogs or two handlers and 50 dogs, and it's really sad. But now I see why you don't see any teams coming out of villages anymore. You know, matter how, you know, good the dogs are or something, you know, you just can't compete. The money's not in the villages.
Zeray says what used to characterize just a few elite Iditarod teams is common today, with $1,500 dogs leading teams as far back as 40th place. Suffering the consequences, his village dogs running deep in the pack, Zeray scratched from the Iditarod in Ruby this week. Out of the top 20 and the money, he says the decision was an effort to cut potentially exorbitant transportation costs back to Tanana from further down the trail. With what is most likely his last Iditarod now over, Zeray punctuates the demise of other bush mushers who've gone before him. Athabascan dog racer Emmett Peters of Ruby has run many Iditarods and won the event in 1975.
Everywhere you go in the villages, from here to there, and frankly, every family has got a snow machine, which 20 years ago, one out of three families got a dog team. Years ago, back in 1975, 73, we can run the Iditarod with $3,500. Now, you can't even come close to $30,000 to be a contender.
Peter still has his team, however, and says he'll jump right back into racing when he gets a sponsor. He says he'd like to see the Iditarod develop a 50 and over senior division, which he thinks would bring back a lot of former champions, as well as a lot of interest from the villages. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
Representatives of All Vest and Wackenhut outlined their proposal to the city council Monday night, asking for a quick decision. All Vest President Bill Weimar says if the city doesn't vote to support the project in the next week or two, the proposal will go nowhere. That prompted Councilman Tim Plummer to ask the city manager to draft a resolution in support of discussing the idea with the state. The company is seeking support for the project from legislators and Governor Tony Knowles' administration, which has itself proposed turning the Harborview Developmental Center into a 50-bed substance abuse facility for state prisoners. Former Corrections Commissioner Frank Pruitt, who's working under contract for Wackenhut, says his proposal may help relieve prison overcrowding in the state.
It's the governor's responsibility to operate the correctional system. It's the legislature's responsibility to drive public policy. And it isn't sound public policy to have a correctional system that's so full that it's accruing sanctions, that that inmates are attacking one another, guards, and setting up a very dangerous situation.
Pruitt says a privately run prison would cost as little as $65 per day per inmate, compared to $107 per day for state-run facilities. Weimar says this project would be cheaper because it would pay corrections officers less than state employees. The prison would employ up to 100 people, about half of whom would be corrections officers. And Pruitt says it's likely that current Harborview employees could be retrained to work at the prison. Weimar says that's a selling point for the project.
Well, the governor feels a commitment to the people of Valdez, and that's why he was making some effort with the 50-bed treatment program. So that's certainly helpful. He's inclined to want to do something, for Valdez, to compensate for the Harborview shutdown. So this is one way to do that.
Weimar says the current facility would need to be upgraded to include new housing and a gymnasium, costing between $8 million and $12 million. Weimar wants the city to finance the construction and says he'll ask the state for a 20-year contract. Weimar says that would guarantee the city's investment. But one question that remains to be answered is whether the residents want a prison in their town. A meeting has been scheduled for April 9th to hear what people think. The city council will vote next Monday on whether to support discussing the project with the state. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
After six rounds of balloting, Will Mayo was chosen for a second term to serve as president of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Mayo edged out Robert Silas in the final round of voting during TCC's convention Thursday. Delegates to the three-day convention spoke often of decentralizing services away from the Fairbanks office, a task Mayo says he will pursue.
In the next 3 years, we'll be identifying what can be moved to the village level without hurting and damaging services, and without weakening our regional unity.
With about 80% of its funding coming from the federal government, TCC's been dealing with shrinking revenues in recent years, that at a time when villages have been designated as tribes and demanding more say in their governance. Mayo's term runs for 3 years. He'll be serving with a new vice president, Donnie Flegel, from McGrath. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. 3-2-1. After 6 rounds of balloting, Will Mayo was chosen for a second term to serve as president of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Mayo edged out Robert Silas in the final round of voting during TCC's convention Thursday. Delegates to the 3-day meeting spoke often of decentralizing services away from the Fairbanks office, a task Mayo says he will pursue.
In the next 3 years, we'll be identifying what can be moved to the village level without hurting and damaging services, and without weakening our regional unity. So in 3 years, I would see a greater tribal activity, but also the balance of keeping our regional voice strong.
With about 80% of its funding coming from the federal government, TCC's been dealing with shrinking revenues in recent years. That at a time when villages have been designated as tribes and demanding more say in their governance. Mayo was clearly gratified to win again, and he promises to listen more to village leaders.
The key will be to include the villages in the adjustments that have to be made, to put together the options that you have available, and then take it to them and ask them, what do you think of this and that? That's the main thing that I've learned over the years, is don't just do it like on your own. They want to know what's happening. They want to make the choice.
Mayo's term runs for 3 years. He'll be serving with a new vice president, Donnie Flegel, from McGrath. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. Effie Cochran's known to many people as plain old Grandma Effie. Born in Tanana, she moved to Fairbanks in the early 1950s, and ever since has worked to pass on strong values through her Native education classes at a variety of schools. She says she was honored to be recognized by the Borough Assembly.
I thought they were just there to take our taxes, and when they told me I was going to get an award for them, I was very surprised, and I didn't know what it was all about, but I was sure proud to get the award from them, because I didn't know that they'd done that, and the award itself spoke pretty much of just my involvement, and that's just, you know, part of my involvement.
Grandma Effie's an accomplished skin sewer and bead worker. She turned 77 this weekend, but she's also known as a 3-time winner of the Women's North American Sled Dog Race, an event that has evolved as part of the Open North American races that just finished on Sunday.
I've been busy, except yesterday afternoon I went to sleep listening to the dog race. I went out there one day, but I rather listened to it on the radio. You get the full coverage that way. When you go out on the bank and watch it, you see a lot of people, you visit a lot of people, but you don't see much of the races.
The award was especially appreciated, she says, because just before she received it, she was recovering from a small heart attack that put her in the hospital. But it didn't slow her down too much. She's scheduled to speak this week at the university, then in April, fly to Colorado to see a daughter graduate from college.
There's always something to do. There's always something to look forward to. Whatever you can do, you know, you just do the best. And look at me, just like I'm not involved in anything. I feel like it's my everyday life. But it seems to others that I am involved.
In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Reverend Charles Brown is gratified by official and community concern, but he and other African Americans want action. 2 weeks ago, Brown testified to the school board about reports of racist pamphlets and an escalating war of words between black and whites in district schools. He and other black leaders also met with the Fairbanks Community Coalition, a group that wants to nip racism in the bud. But Brown says raising awareness isn't enough.
By no means are we going to allow or give up our focus to to the administration or the school board to pursue this, because we feel that we need to take a lead in accomplishing the things that need to be done. And those who wish to join with us, they are certainly welcome to join with us after we've formulated our plans and directed and begin to implement those plans.
Brown acknowledges racism is a community disease, but he adds African Americans will be watching what actions the school board takes in ending what he thinks is an institutional insensitivity to minority concerns. Bette Schaffhauser is the school district's point woman on equality. She says the district takes racism seriously and points to recommendations they're already crafting based on the meeting with African American leaders.
We talked about having emergency plans in place in the event that disruptive events would occur at the schools. We also talked in terms of ensuring communication between the African American community in scheduling quarterly meetings between the leadership of the African American community and the school district to share information.
Schaffhauer says the district will also seek the support of the community at large in dealing with school racism, and she hopes to place a resolution addressing the issue before the school board in the near future, even as Brown and other African Americans watch to see if the board walks the talk. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. Dean Brown, president of Princess Tours, says though the lodge is closed for the season, caretakers reported the fire just after 7 in the morning. He says the fire seems to have started in the lobby or restaurant, but it's still too soon to know the source of the fire or the cost of repair.
Yeah, we have a crew headed up there that'll be able to see what the damage is, and then we've got 2 months to do reconstruction before the scheduled opening as it is. So, you know, we try to remain optimistic on that account.
Firefighters used bulldozers and a helicopter to control the blaze and contained it by afternoon. Mary Jo Clark with the Tri-Valley Fire Department says a good portion of the hotel was destroyed.
From what I understand, that the lobby area, gift shop, some of the offices, 150 rooms are gone. The formal dining room to the back of the building is gone. What is intact is the new unit of rooms, the laundry room, the water treatment plant, and I believe employee housing. They're all fine and intact.
Clark says the whole community pitched in to fight the fire.
We have water stations set up a mile down the road, a pump station by the river. And Red Cross is set up at the Sam Bake across the road, and people are just running back, filling air tanks and everything we can do. And Mountain View and Larry's are sending fluids down for the firefighters.
The state fire marshal is on the scene and investigating. This is another major setback for a company that brings thousands of tourists to the state. Last year, a Princess cruise ship struck a rock, canceling hundreds of tourist reservations across the nation. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Admiral Eugene Carroll commanded the carrier strike force in the Mediterranean 2 decades ago and later directed U.S. military operations in Europe and in the Middle East. Today, he's retired and deputy director for the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. These days, he advises policymakers in the Pentagon, State Department, and Congress. UAF engineering professor Ron Johnson is a member of the group bringing the admiral to Alaska. He says CDI has a neutral stance for the most part, making it and Carroll widely sought after by foreign governments as well.
For example, before coming here, he was invited by the Cuban military to talk to them about their military posturing vis-a-vis the United States. And before that, he was invited to talk to some Russian military leaders about what their military posture might be and what was a sane way for them to keep a strong military capability while building for peace around the world.
Johnson, who learned about Admiral Carroll through his own support of the CDI's Neither Hawk Nor Dove military monitoring, says the current military budget costs the nation $5 billion a week, $8,000 a second. More than enough, he says, to do the job.
We want to have a strong military so that people won't be misled into thinking that they can start a war and get away with doing harm to their neighbors but yet at the same time not to overdo it, not to have unneeded weapons systems and more military personnel than we need to carry out the defense of our country, plus aid our friends around the world.
Admiral Carroll has criticized plans to expand military operating areas, including those in Alaska. Tonight he'll discuss proposals for reducing the military budget without sacrificing strength. He speaks at the Wood Center Ballroom on campus at 7:30. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
The Illinois Creek Mine Project means one thing to folks in this area, jobs. USMX and their partner D.H. Blattner & Sons plan to hire about 100 people to staff the silver and gold hard rock mine at Illinois Creek. The companies have named local hire as their primary goal. Mine officials, along with representatives from the State Departments of Natural Resources, Environmental Conservation, and Fish and Game, visited local villages this week to gather public comments for the various state permits required. But most of the people who attended the meeting in Galena wanted to know about the employment opportunities at the mine. The mine is located on land owned by the Cook Inlet Region Incorporated. The owners plan to search for employees to staff the operation from the six local villages first, then open the jobs to Siri shareholders. USMX Vice President of Operations Paul Valenti says development plans call for the transportation of equipment to begin this spring. The supplies will be trucked to Nenana, then barged to Galena, and flown in cargo planes to the remote campsite.
Well, given that we do get our permits, we're expecting that the project construction will take place in June and July and in August, and that it's our ultimate goal to start producing gold in the latter part of September.
Initially, USMX wanted to build a haul road to the mine site, but abandoned that plan due to the costs related. Valenti says the project is financially feasible only because of the existing airstrips at both Galena and the mine site.
The toughest thing for us has been to get a real handle on logistics and the costs related to transportation, and that's taken us longer really to come to grips with those types of things, because the actual mining and processing of the ore we understand very well. And we're still a little bit on the learning curve about how to do business in the interior, although we've come a long way in the last year.
Valenti says the developers hope to find enough gold to keep them busy for the next 6 years. People in this area are happy to hear about a job that will get them through the next winter. Reporting in Galena, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Valley City Hall wasn't built high enough to keep groundwater from seeping into the basement. That has led to a significant buildup of mold, and several employees suspected that the mold was causing their afternoon headaches and lethargy at work. But the consultant says the mold does not pose an immediate health risk, and that it may be carbon dioxide that's to blame for the headaches and lethargy. City Public Works Director Bill Wilcox says, according to the consultant, the symptoms mentioned by the workers are classic signs of a carbon dioxide problem, not a mold problem.
And his recommendation was to go into the offices and check to see if there was an elevated level of carbon dioxide in the afternoon in those rooms. And if there was, address that as a carbon dioxide problem.
Wilcox says that would be totally unrelated to the mold in the basement. And where's the carbon dioxide coming from? Wilcox says people's own exhalation. Not all of the offices in City Hall have vents, and the air may not be circulating enough, especially since the weather is usually too cold to have windows open. Police Chief Bert Cottle says he isn't convinced by the consultant's report that the mold is not a health risk. Cottle, whose workers have shower and locker facilities in the basement, says the consultant's recommendations deal only with problems caused by having a leaky basement. Cottle says maybe what the city should do instead is fix the leak. Among the consultant's recommendations are cleaning whatever dirt and mold is in the basement now and replacing moldy sheetrock on the basement walls with mold-resistant sheetrock. Wilcox says the city anticipates that those actions will dramatically reduce the potential for a future mold problem. The city plans to undertake the recommended steps. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
7 feet of new snow cut short the attempts of two winter soloists to Denali recently. But Alaskan Todd Deese continues to move forward with his plans for the summit at the end of this week. Deese will be too late for a winter ascent, but leaves Sunday or Monday to solo the West Buttress and attempt a ski descent from the top. Two climbers, Canadian Derek Stanberry and Frenchman Gerard Perrault, flew off the Kehiltna Glacier less than a week after their arrival at base camp.
K2 aviation pilot flying over the glacier on the 29th of February saw both men with their arms over their heads, signing they wished to be picked up. Stanberry's pilot, Paul Roderick, was contacted, flew to base camp, and saw both men waist-deep in the snow. He landed the plane, and the three spent the next 6 hours getting the plane unstuck and building a runway. K2 Aviation flew to base camp the next day and picked up Perot. The Frenchman is now on his way to Hawaii. In Talkeetna, I'm Kathy Sullivan.
Just shy of mile 400 on the Iditarod Trail, the community of McGrath, as little as 10 years ago, had several large kennels in town which produced Iditarod race teams on a regular basis. Today, dog teams are a less common sight in McGrath, with just a few small recreational teams left in town. In an attempt to change the current trend, for the third year in a row, the McGrath School Mushing Club, led by science teacher and mushing enthusiast Norv Dallin, has been doing its part to revive competitive dog racing amongst a new generation of local kids. Their most recent race, a 3-mile, 3-dog event on the Kuskokwim River, saw 9 entrants, sunny skies, and lots of enthusiasm.
You have to kind of shift your weight on the sled and tell them that ha or do.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
The whole goal behind this is to get kids interested in mushing. This year's been a bad measure because the weather hasn't cooperated with us very well, so kids haven't been out practicing a lot, but still they're enthusiastic and having lots of fun, we hope, today.
You worry about your kids when they're out there?
Oh, every time. Every time. Yeah, of course.
That crashed. We hit a sharp turn and the sled tipped.
Stay on.
I fell off and I just yelled whoa to them and they stopped.
It's a nice sport. If they aren't good with the dogs aren't going to run for them. And so it's a team sport in that sense. And they have to be responsible for feeding them and taking care of them and all the hard work as well as the fun of racing.
In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
The word thank you translated into Quechin is merci. It's a loan word borrowed from the French-Canadian and comes from an earlier time when the two peoples were first getting to know one another. You can hear merci in merci. Quechins use the word merci quite frequently, and it makes me think that others might use it more often too. I think it's pleasant to hear thank you between husband and wife. Many of us forget to say it and take family for granted. It's sad to treat your relatives that way. Do this and do that from dads, moms, bosses, and other authority figures takes a pleasure out of doing simple tasks. My friend Snook Herbert, a local broadcaster on KZPA, Gwanduk Radio in Fort Yukon, criticized the word masicho on his show, and the phones ring loud. Masi simply means thank you or thanks for doing a favor or a good deed. Masi cho means big thank you. Snook thought to say big thank you in English was unnecessary. Who in the world would say big thank you? Well, Snook heard from the people. Maybe his aunt. Anyway, a very well-versed speaker called long distance and explained to Snook sternly that when a person says masi cho in Quechin, it comes from the heart. So there's a lesson in saying little thanks or big thanks. Merci for listening to your heart. From Fort Yukon, I'm Marilyn Savage.
School board members heard last week of racial strife at both West Valley and North Pole High Schools. Now that the word is spread, the Tanana Valley Conference of Churches has gotten involved. Conference President Al Levitt says leaders from member churches have passed a resolution condemning recent acts of intolerance.
What we're doing in this statement is responding to these two specific situations that have arisen just since last fall. And the concern that we have about the levels of hatred that have been expressed last fall toward the homosexual community, and whatever is happening here in North Pole and perhaps elsewhere as well regarding racial tensions in the community.
Levitt says the resolution's been in the works since the fall, when a library display on Gay and Lesbian History Month prompted outrage from some corners. The conference spoke then and is speaking again. Church leaders are hoping to join with others to challenge intolerance. They're doing so just before members of the Socially Liberal Community Coalition meet with members of African American organizations. Reverend Charles Brown says the Community Coalition invited him and others to talk about the next step.
We're going to ask for participation, and I think if we can come to an agreement where the community can set the standard and say, not only am I concerned about what happens to me, but I'm concerned about what happens to my neighbor, then I think we can shine a light on this disease that operates best in darkness and to cause it to diminish to such a degree that all of our citizens would be able to live peaceful and productive lives.
Brown says he'll ask the Community Coalition to act in concert with other organizations to address the area's continuing problems. But some are already acting. A group of first responders met Monday and have begun asking people to wear multicolored ribbons representing people of the many races who live here. They plan to bring their ribbons to local schools as well as to the Community Coalition's meeting set for this evening at 7 in the Southside Community Center. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
As musher and team, a long-distance journey like the Iditarod has an appeal, not just like the highest mountain, but for the time spent together. Over the past week, in talking to a lot of mushers as they passed through the McGrath checkpoint, three in particular, and what they had to say about their dogs, struck me as what the Iditarod is mostly about for most of the pack, spending time with dogs and exploring the uniquely loyal and frustrating relationship we share.
Good girl you are. Yeah.
My star is the little girl right here. Her name's Corpus Christi, and she's only 23 months old. She's not quite 2 years old yet, and she has led this race more than two-thirds of the way. She's just a remarkable dog. We wouldn't have kept going without her.
Well, my favorite dog is one of my leaders, Copper. He's just a real mellow guy. I hook him up. He never barks. He just turns around, sits and waits and looks at me. And this is real hard for people to believe, but I can get on a trail and we'll kind of get in tune with each other. And I'll just think, go gee, and he'll do it. Not every time, but like 9 out of 10 times, you know. And it's strange. It's hard for me to believe, but, you know, we're just real in tune to each other.
I think the one that's outstanding for me is Pal, who's my leader and has led every race I've run since 1990. And he's now 10 years old, and I think past his best. And he's the most lovable and the most frustrating dog you could ever wish to have, but I think the world of him, you know. I mean, coming down into McGrath, he just got to the point where he wanted a rest. And he's in lead, and he knew exactly how to get a rest. And you go up a hill, and he didn't just lift his leg at the top of the hill. He turned back, came down the team, halfway down, just out of reach of me, and then just stared me straight in the eyes and lifted his leg and would not move. But he's such a character. I love him anyway. You know, they're all characters, really.
With special thanks to Iditarod mushers Linda Joy, Roy Monk, and Michael Noshko on the Iditarod Trail in McGrath, I'm Dan Broth.
Like any elected office, being president of the Tanana Chiefs Conference involves a lot of politics. Current President Will Mayo was elected in 1991, and since then has overseen radical changes in the way government programs are administered. Native organizations can now contract with federal agencies to administer health and other services. That's created a lot of opportunity as well as uncertainty, and this year, 9 candidates are vying to lead TCC through the maze. Mayo says having 8 other candidates in the field ensures fair representation from many perspectives.
I don't think there's any big issue dividing the delegates. It's not like somebody on one side of abortion, you know, who against somebody on the other side. We don't have that kind of a. I'm not aware of any fundamental splits or issues that are being carried by the candidates.
Of 9 candidates, 6 live in the Fairbanks area. They are TCC's current Vice President Herbert Edwin, Agriculture Programs Director Alfred Ketzler Jr., Planning Director Gary Moore, and Village Liaison Robert Silas and Employment Rights Officer Jules Wright. Nenana Village Chief Mitch Domenef is also running. He says the next president of TCC needs to focus more on local issues and to make sure villages are better able to take advantage of opportunities to contract for local services.
Compacting is one piece of the pie. The other pieces of the pie are to let TCC administer the programs, and the third, and the more difficult to obtain, is the mature contractor status, in which you would then have the option to contract under 93638, under the Indian Self-Determination Act. Okay, so in order to be truly self-determined, you have to become a mature contractor. That's really where villages need to get to in order to be truly self-determined.
Domenef says the next president needs to spend more time working on local rather than state and national issues. In conversations with delegates, many say TCC needs to change. Fort Yukon Chief Steve Guinness says he'd like to see a reorganization to move more functions out to sub-regional offices.
My contention is that over the years we've built a huge bureaucracy that has caused a lot of frustrations among the member village tribes. And my idea of a reorganization would be to shift the technical assistance responsibilities to the sub-region, which would then require reducing the central office operations here in Fairbanks.
As delegates choose a president this week, they'll also draw advice from elders attending the convention. In addresses Tuesday, many advise delegates to strengthen village ties, but without diluting the influence TCC holds in statewide politics. In his keynote address, Galena Elder Sidney Huntington urged caution, saying dissolving TCC could cause more harm than good. The president's term lasts for 3 years, voting set for Thursday afternoon. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
At best, mining's an uncertain business, but when a company invests several $100 million, it has to remain committed. The Red Dog Mine's first 5 years were marked by unforeseen difficulties in processing ore. That required expensive equipment modifications, and NANA Chief Operating Officer John Rentz says the percentage of zinc recovered was lower than expected.
When the mine actually opened, there are always changes in the way it behaves, and you hope you've allowed for all that, you hope you've given yourself leeway. That wasn't the case at Red Dog. There needed to be more grinding, and in order to get that, you need more power in the power plant, and there needed to be changes in the circuitry to just make the whole throughput better, and it took several years to work all those things out.
Rent says the improvements helped bring costs under control last year, and zinc recovery's up. Still, with zinc prices hovering at 46 cents a pound, the mine is barely covering costs. Even so, the company's spending close to $200 million more for additional upgrades that officials expect will lower costs further. With Red Dog's known reserves already equal to 5 of the world's 8 largest zinc mines, Rent says this mine will likely keep a strong market share.
There are other mines that are going to be closing, and the message and the reason that other people have to consider this, though, is that if you had another mine that was undeveloped today, you now have to factor in these increases at Red Dog in doing your own marketing.
The mine currently employs some 400 people, including 200 Alaska Natives. And with more exploration and expansion planned this summer, Rent says he'll be looking for more help.
We're starting a period of training. We know that we're going to need about 90 to 100 more people. And there's training going on, initial group of 20 that are residents of the area that will be getting involved. And then they'll be working at the mine from now till expansion. And that the human resource employment side will be a big effort in the next few years.
Most of the world's zinc's used by heavy industry and automakers. As those industries grow, they'll draw down zinc supplies and eventually push prices up. Rents puts Red Dog on a 10-year plan toward profitability, and when that happens, it'll begin sharing dividends with other native corporations. In Fairbanks, I'm Marilee McDonald.
It's by no means a rush, but miners and rock hounds have been visiting the State Geological Survey to pick up the latest data from a geophysical mapping program conducted last summer. In the previous 4 years, the state's contracted with a Canadian company to fly surveys across various parts of the state thought to hold valuable minerals. Project manager Laurel Burns says the maps provide a look at places that can't be seen with the naked eye, much less a rock hammer.
They allow you to determine what the geology is underneath the tundra and the bogs. So you could trace a particular unit you're looking at, or you can find where the faults are, which might concentrate gold or other economic minerals.
The latest survey concentrates on the Manly and Rampart mining districts. It's the seventh in a series of maps, costing the state roughly $2 million. They're sold to the public for the cost of reproduction. Milt Wiltsey, the acting director of the survey, says each area is chosen after considering several factors.
I think what's significant is that we have tried to target the program to areas of high mineral potential, where we have reasonable access, and where the local population wants to see mining development, so that we've tended to concentrate on the core of historical mining districts.
Wiltsey says the surveys are part of an information infrastructure that promotes industry in much the same way that building a road allows access to new land. And once the maps are made, the exploration dollars follow.
Where these surveys are conducted, we have found that the mining activity, the exploration interest, invariably increases, and usually in the very short term, in the matter of months to a year.
Last year, after the agency released a map of the Fairbanks District, miners staked claims on more than 100 square miles. Latico Resources, a company involved with developing the $27 million True North mine near Fairbanks, credits the map with helping it on a similar find called the Juniper property, 38 miles northeast of Fairbanks. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
In traditional sense, we don't have a word like theater. We have our own native words, like different types of ceremonials that occurred, Eskimo dancing or Indian dances, that occurred throughout the whole year. That's something that they lived with. It was part of their cycle.
Teresa John was a university student when Duma first came to life. Now she's an assistant professor in the Alaska Native Studies Department and one of Duma's directors. She says in the 70s, it took a while for Duma to find a home at UAF. Finally, it settled in the theater department, and what started as a way to preserve cultural values began to conform itself to the stage. Over the years, Duma's reputation has grown, and by and large, interior audiences have liked what they've seen.
But in the native perspective, in a traditional native perspective, I've had some of my colleagues, some faculty members and staff, people questioning me, like, is this true Alaska Native performance that you are doing as a theater department or as a Duma theater department?
In recent years, John says Native participation has declined. Productions have been less cultural, more theatrical, and more non-Native students have taken on Native roles.
One summer, my grandfather was sitting by the bank, and all of a sudden he heard something. He didn't know what he heard. Anyway, he looked up in the air, and he saw airplane was coming. He said, "Snare, Agnes, what's that I hear?"
This year, Duma made a change that may bring it closer to its roots. Minto elder Evelyn Alexander and her niece Ruth Grant have spent the winter working with the company and with students in Teresa John's Native Studies class. The two elders have shared stories, song, and dances, and are leading players in Nam Gen Iha, the 1996 Duma production. Alexander, who is 79, was a little girl when the first steamboats arrived in interior Alaska. She has passed on stories from her childhood and others she learned from her own Minto elders. Teresa John says these stories, like her own Yupik ones, are more than tales, more than oral history. They are a link between the generations. John describes it looking at herself.
None of that belongs to Teresa John. It's not me. It's my ancestors. The blood I have, I didn't make. It's my ancestors' blood. The knowledge that I gained, it's from my parents and grandparents, and they gained it from their other grandparents and grandparents, back and so forth, to the back years. So it's a history being lived through my body.
Duma's production is set on a simple stage. A tent and a campfire indicate fish camp. Spruce boughs evoke the forest. As Alexander and Grant tell their stories, the players come and go on the stage, acting out events associated with the arrival of the whites and older stories that have traveled across the millennia.
This is the story about how the old crew named the tribes. He named the tribes of Caribou Teal, Middle Tribe, Fish Teal, Tsihu. Rabbit's Teal stands for Tsihu. And this is the way the tribe come out.
John's not sure Duma should be a theater company any longer. She worries that the Western influence will be a barrier to its first constituency, that the longer it stays on the stage, the harder it will be for Duma to work as a culture bearer for the Native students and for the interior Native community. This year, it's staying where it is, but reaching out to living roots.
This is the first step I see, bringing the elders into the program, which is one of the most, it should be the first thing we do, and we are doing it this semester.
Nam is a Yupik word. Roughly translated, it means, I don't know. Gen Ihu is Athabascan for whatever. Together, they are the title of this year's performance. Duma, the path. Nam, Gen Ihu. Perhaps an uncertain path. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
One. School board officials hadn't expected their regular meeting to turn into a public testimony about problems of racism in the schools, but Tuesday night, they extended the public comment period to hear from more than a dozen people, like Reverend Charles Brown.
If swastikas are openly placed on students' lockers and desks at North Pole High, and KKK literature is openly circulated within the West Valley High School environment, we are convinced that a racial climate exists. We believe that that climate exists more as a result of the attitudes of the staff than of the students.
Brown and others were fresh from a meeting Monday night in which students spoke of a hostile climate within area schools, a climate they say many teachers and staff not only tolerate, but actually disregard. Parent Lily Mitchell says her children feel they have no one to tell at the school.
I am not shocked, but I am very appalled to know that this is taking place not only in our high schools, but in our elementary schools. I cannot begin to tell you how deeply I hurt and what the pain feels like when my children come home and tell me the names and the things that have been said to them, things that have been done to them in the school, and they do not feel that they have any support from their teachers or from the administration. And a lot of times they just save the information for me to deal with when they come home.
Many of the stories center on an incident which began a week ago at North Pole High School. Principal Dan McDaniel says as many as 30 students have been engaging in a war of words that prompted him to encourage some of them to stay home as part of a cooling off period. McDaniel says he was surprised to learn of skinheads active in his own halls.
We have three or four students who are pretty much openly at this point espousing their skinhead views. One of them did withdraw from school at my request. Other students have been suspended. We're taking a very active role in this. My number one priority right now is safety in the school. And like I said, we've been thus far, with the help of the Norfolk Police, I've been able to prevent any fights happening from after school or during the school day. There's been no injuries or anything like that.
McDaniel says he's spoken with parents of the students involved, but has received mixed reactions from some parents who told him that until punches are thrown, there's really no problem. Board officials were surprised by the testimony. Member Bob Boko says he and others had no idea what's been happening.
I know that many of the board members here did not really know what had transpired, and we feel we're out of the picture. You know what I mean? We're out of the picture now because we haven't been informed, and we should have been informed as to what went on. And I'm sure that I can speak for the rest of the people on the board that this is something that is not a standard operating procedure in our schools and shouldn't be and never will be.
Boko and other board members agreed to meet with the parents, many of whom urged the enlistment of outside groups with experience dealing with racism. Meanwhile, at North Pole High, Principal McDaniel says a new student intervention group is scheduled to begin meeting Friday. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is attempting to improve the wildlife habitat in the Goldstream Creek area by, of all things, driving a cat over 200 acres. Project Supervisor Dale Hagstrom.
We're going to crush some willows. We've hired a contractor to use a D8 caterpillar to break off and shear the old willows that are out there. Our intent is to try to rejuvenate the old willow, make them put up new shoots.
Nature usually uses fire to renew habitat, but as more people have moved into the valley, Hagstrom says managers have had to use other tools.
We're using mechanical means because it's too dangerous to use fire. This area is a lowland area. It's wet a lot of the summer. It has a lot of grass and dead stems now in it. It would burn if it was very dry, had been dry for a prolonged period of time.
The department conducted a similar project in the early 80s along the Toke River that Hagstrom says resulted in a tenfold increase in habitat productivity. While designed to help the current moose population, it is not intended to increase their numbers. Further, the Goldstream project is designed with buffer zones to minimize conflicts between people and wildlife.
The main concern that people have expressed about this project is that it might increase the number of problems between moose and people, either moose being hit by cars or moose attacking dog teams or skiers. And we think that we can actually minimize those occurrences by where we place the treated areas.
This is part of several habitat rejuvenation projects planned this year as part of a $350,000 state appropriation. Other projects include logging 5 acres of old birch at Creamer's Field and burning about 20,000 acres in the Tanana Flats. In Fairbanks, I'm Fred Brantingham.
Princess Tours is asking the Matsu Borough for permission to survey borough land adjacent to its lodge property at mile 133 of the park's highway. Princess Vice President Tom Dow says the land in question includes 2 miles of borough property that lie between Princess Holdings and Blair Lake.
We're investigating the feasibility of establishing a surface trail link between the hotel property and Blair Lake. And in order to do that, the preliminary phase of this kind of reconnaissance is to have permission from the borough to access borough lands for the purpose of doing a preliminary survey of a potential route.
Dow says that if their request is approved, Princess would pay for an engineering survey and conduct a feasibility analysis for establishment of a trail. Matsu Land Management Officer Jill Parsons says her office will review the Princess application by the end of the week. Parsons says Princess has several options for using the land. It could purchase an easement, buy land near the road, or buy land near the lake. Dow says there are 2 undeveloped, privately held parcels on Blair Lake, with the rest of the properties on state or borough land. He says Princess has not approached the owners about purchasing their land. Before Princess could begin construction of a trail, they would first have to apply for and obtain an easement from the borough. Once they applied for an easement across borough lands, the borough would be required to give public notice and initiate a public approval process. Eventually, the matter would go to the borough manager or assembly for approval. In Talkeetna, I'm Greg Schweitzer.
The committee was organized by the Prince William Sound Economic Development Council with $300,000 in funding from the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council. Paul Ropeman, executive director of the EDC, describes the committee's work as the first collaborative planning effort by the cities of Whittier, Valdez, and Cordova, and the villages of Tetitlik and Chenega Bay.
The communities of Prince William Sound don't traditionally work together on things. They're very independent. That's what we wanted to focus on, was getting these communities to work together. Maybe we'll achieve some economies of scale to achieve a desired outcome. Maybe we'll save some money. Maybe we can do some things as a region. But at least we're looking at all of the problems as a region, and maybe some of the solutions will be independent, but still the solutions were developed through a regional process and a grassroots process at that.
Ropeman says the committee members initially identified 30 waste streams that needed to be addressed and trimmed the list down to 5: municipal solid waste, household hazardous waste, used oil, lead-acid batteries, and recyclable materials. Correspondingly, the Sound Waste Management Plan includes 5 recommendations. Ropeman says one is for household hazardous waste collection events in each community using a Department of Environmental Conservation waste mobile.
It will come to town, and it'll be this big community event where you bring your waste oil, bring your used oil, oil filters, all those hazardous wastes that accumulate in a home, and you'll be able to bring those, and we will handle them, and the city will deal with them at these events. Along with that is an educational component to how do you properly dispose of these wastes.
Ropeman says the training would be provided by DEC. Another recommendation is for community-sponsored recycling programs for aluminum and cardboard, with other materials collected as feasible. Those programs would replace current volunteer-led efforts. The plan also calls for a comprehensive used oil management system and the construction of an environmental operations station in each community. Those stations would be a central place for the community's used oil, recycling, and household hazardous waste activities. Ropeman says the EDC will ask the Trustee Council for approximately $1 million to build those facilities. The communities would be expected to provide land for them and to cover operations and maintenance costs. The Sound Waste Management Plan does not answer the big question of where solid waste from the various communities should be disposed of. The plan does include a comparative analysis of 9 waste disposal alternatives and recommends that each community use that analysis as a guide for discussion of the issue. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
Okay, here is the intro for the Solid Waste Management Plan story. A more than 16-month effort to develop a waste management plan for Prince William Sound is coming to an end this week. A committee met Wednesday to finish up its work on the plan, and Greg Williams has more.
Okay. Here we go in 3, 2, 1. Galena residents woke up yesterday morning to find icy roads and slippery paths blocking their way to work and school. According to Galena City Manager Chal Taylor, it was a mess out there. Taylor says the city had crews working with the grader and laying gravel to try to make the roads passable. Even Mayor Russ Sweetser was out shoveling gravel onto roads and driveways. Cars and snow machines had trouble staying on the road. One of the slipperiest sections of roadway is on the back dike in Old Town Galena, where 7 vehicles reportedly slipped off the street. The Galena City School District canceled classes yesterday because it was too dangerous to run the school bus. That didn't stop the kids from playing outside, though, with temperatures so warm after a long cold winter. A few kids were spotted ice skating down a residential lane early yesterday morning. Reporting from Galena, where all the world's an ice rink, I'm Teresa Bacher.
That's beautiful.
Very nice.
Go.
Unseasonably warm weather has descended on most of the interior, bringing rain and melting snow to its communities. Temperatures have been in the 30s and 40s for the past 2 days.
What's it doing in Galena? Is it snowing and stuff and raining?
It's raining, yeah.
Okay. And do you know what the high temperature was today?
Yep, 34.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
I'll talk to you tomorrow. Okay,
right.
Bye, Susan.
Bye.
But is it easy? This is Neil Smith.